What I thought we might do next is a number of us over the day will talk to check this sort of sheet, which was the original programming for it. Has everyone got one of these or seen what's in the day? Because Leanne's got some spares. Perhaps if you haven't got one, if you put your hand up, Leanne can hand some around. As I said, we'll actually finish by lunchtime, but it'll just give you a little bit of a sense of what topics we might touch on and who might speak. We've got about half an hour, a little bit more, before we go to morning tea. And so I thought two things we might want to do, and again, I'm very much in your hands, but we can, you know, pick up on any issues from Helen's talk and explore those further. The other thing I thought is that there are a number of people in the room who are working on projects of this style who might want to say a few minutes of you know, their thoughts on what they're doing or how it relates to this, where we may not otherwise have a chance to have a full session. So I'm in your hands. I thought perhaps an opportunity for others who are working on this kind of idea to provide just some thoughts on what they are doing, if nothing else, so that we're aware of that, might be a useful way to start. Are people happy if we go that way? Are there some people, quick hands, if you might tell us what you're doing? I'm looking at you, Davinia, among others. Yes, thank you. Yep, a couple. Okay, so how about we do that as just a bit of a who else are doing interesting things, and I'm, you know, completely open to that. And then from that, we'll see how we go on time and then whether there's particular things we want to pick up from Helen or whether that takes us to morning tea, and then when we come back, we'll go to the work Marion's been doing and again, sort of the planners from the UK as a jumping-off point. Okay, so is this one working? Yep, okay. So, Davinia, can I start with you? I'll play roving mic for this.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I'm working in two different lines regarding pedagogical planners. The first one is the work I'm continuing with the University of Valladolid related to what I was doing in my PhD thesis regarding the collage authoring tool, which provides templates formulating collaborative learning patterns that can be reused and refined according to the specific characteristics of a learning situation, so that it becomes a plan, a read-to-run unit of learning. This is also related to your ideas of the new project regarding Lands planner, and it is something interesting for me too, also to try to understand, because you are already reusing, let's say, activity tools as building blocks. So, and what we did in collage is reusing sequences. So this is one of the things I'm doing at the moment, and there we are including new patterns related to assessment, and we are thinking of the decisions at which points the teacher should decide to include a certain kind of assessment or not related to these learning flow patterns. So this is something I'm still working on. And then also related to something that Helen has explained here of the role of the learner when designing their own, let's say, competence development plan, and it's relating to portfolios. And in the 10 competence project that I'm working on in Barcelona at the Pompeu Fabra University, this is an important point in the project. So we are working on a competence development planner with a graphical interface where the learners can create their own learning path, but having suggestions of different learning plans, probably designed by experts, but also learn from what other students have done before. And they have this suggestion that are related to different units of learnings interconnected. So it's at the level of sequences of units of learning. So at course level, let's say, but not at the level of granularity tackled in LANs, for example, or in other new learning designs authoring tools. So this is what I'm working at the moment. So planners, not only for the teachers, but also for the learners at the level of building their own competence development plan composed of units of learning.
Great, thank you for that, Davinia. Just perhaps one thing if I can draw out. So I remember seeing your work a little while ago where you had a jigsaw pattern where people discuss in groups and then individuals get moved around so that you kind of break up the groups to then have different discussions with different subgroups. And what struck me about that was, you know, if I look at that from a LAMS perspective, you might say, well, the underlying tool there is maybe a forum or a chat. It's some very generic sort of tool. But the particular structure of the way it gets used to do a jigsaw is, in fact, that's the important bit of what makes that pedagogy work. And to me, that sort of draws out the distinction between we may have some generic tools in our systems which could do, well, many things, but it is the layering of the way they get used that is sort of the important pedagogical intent on top of that. And so that helps me to at least think about different layers at which we configure structures or patterns. A jigsaw tool may at its core be chat or forum, but that's not the important bit. The important bit is the way it gets used. So, okay, thank you. Next, did you want to?
Yes.
Okay, we'll do some slides for this one quickly.
Yes, if that's...
Sometimes this hasn't been picking up the USB stick.
Yeah.
So if it doesn't, we might do it after the break.
Yeah, sure.
Let's
do you want to grab somebody else?
Yeah, this is the problem we had before. So why don't we'll set this up during the break and come back to the computer.
No problem.
Okay. We had some problem with the USB sticks on that computer. So what we'll do is we'll get it somehow during the break and then present that one in the next session. Anyone else who'd like to share their work or ideas in this area that they're working on?
Do you hear me? Yes. I wanted just to share with you a kind of research line we are undertaking in my university, in my department. We want to use standards, this kind of design planners, just for supporting blended learning in a face-to-face university. So we are especially interested in something that you and your colleague have been talking about if I understood well, the canonical elements that you had to use to describe pedagogies, because in a face-to-face university you don't have so many human resources. And what I wanted to talk with all of you is if there is a kind of group, research group, working on that issues. So just what I wanted to say.
Thank you. Any other projects that people might want to mention? Or again, we can go back to some of the thoughts that Helen was offering. If there's particular things that have been burning that you wanted to pick up on. I know you're all thinking things. It's just what to start with as a topic.
I think for us, in terms of JISC and where we go next with these tools, obviously we've spent the past of 2.5 years working with these projects and funding the projects. And for us now, we're sort of in a situation as to where do we go next with these two tools, which are essentially proof of concept. Are we going to see institutions take up and potentially trial and pilot the use of these systems? There's a lot of, I think, willingness to see the potential of these tools, but at the same time, I think there's sort of a hesitation that because they are proof of concept, institutions are not necessarily willing to sometimes take the risk technically because they know that they are going to need supporting, both in terms of the technical sense and also in terms of staff development sense. So, you know, I think I'd be very interested on hearing people's thoughts in terms of, you know, how do we get some of that critical mass of supporting a community of practice that will start engaging with these tools. And obviously once we have that engagement, we can look at refining the tools further and looking at ways in which they can be customized by institutions or by subject and actually start seeing some sort of work on these in earnest by, you know, institutional take-up of the tools. So I think that's where we are at the moment, you know, faced with a challenge.
I think that's a really difficult. Can you hear me? I think that's a really difficult thing because unless we get people really trying these things out in anger, I think all of us who've been in the space have had the frustration of, and I think Lambs actually, James, has gone further than most. But for the majority of this, if we take devil's advocate for one moment, you know, we go out, we run workshops, lots of enthusiasm, blah de blah de blah. But actually then it's forgotten. And we know in reality it's all at the proof of concept stage. We've never really tried these things out in anger, you know, over a long period of time. So as I say, Lambs has probably done more of that than anything else. And until we get that and really see if it make, you know, how people use it over time, we're not going to get a change in practice and we're not going to see if they really make a difference. So it's a really difficult conundrum, if you like, for people like JISC in terms of funding this. Do you go on funding particular tools, or do you stop and say, right, well, let's look at where we've got? I haven't got the answer, but it seems a really fundamental problem.
Yeah, hi. It is, I actually have a practitioner's view on this. I came to a university about 6 years ago, and it had one of these very fancy programs. And our dean was in love with it, and it cost a hilarious amount of money. And they said, we all have to use it. So, you know, being new to university and say, of course, I'll trial it. And it had lots of problems, and it was just, you know, adding to our workload. And no one else in my faculty would use it. And I asked, why don't you use this program? They said they don't see the value adding nature of it to students and to staff, and it just creates much more work. So I dropped using it after a semester as well, and our dean just kept pushing and said, look, we spent so much money on it, you guys have to use it because it costs so much money, and everyone would just refuse to use it. And then I came across Lambs, and I fell totally in love with it, and I said, this is exactly what I want. And no one told me that I need to use it, and no one told me I have to go and do a workshop on it. I just did it all myself, but no one else in my faculty would. But I just didn't care. I said, I want to use this beside everything else. And I kept going with it, and now students go and really like it. Although we do have some technical problems with it. Students still like it. So what they do is they go to other lecturers and say, why don't you use LAMS? You know, we use it in one unit. We'd like to keep using it in other units. And I think this is where we start getting the critical mass. If people see the value-adding nature, and also it may add to workload, it really serves students in a particular way, rather than the top-down approach, you know, through the, you know, big power structures of universities.
Good morning. How many percent of your professors at your university, are they use a pedagogical planner when before they enter an amphitheater theater? Because in our university they don't use, especially for the technical, and maybe the pedagogical professor do it, but I am not sure. And for them, and this is the problem, because if we try to give a tool for a needs that maybe does not exist for them, exists for education, but not for educators in the reality, where are we going?
Perhaps if I can add one, if I take off my official lamb's hat and everything and just put back on my, I do some courses in education these days. You know, I actually have an honest job as a lecturer. And I use lambs in those courses, you know, from time to time. But if I was to be brutally honest about how that works, when I think of the London Planner in particular, the one from London Knowledge Lab, all the things that are in that planner, the things you should reflect on about the course objectives, the student needs, the way that they are aligned, and flow that down to courses. I know that's right. The bit inside me says, yes, I should do that. But I am so busy doing everything I do that I don't find enough time to sit and think that through properly. And so there's a part of me that knows it's the right thing to do. I feel morally obliged that I should be doing all this planning, and yet the constraints of my busy life as a teacher mean I don't get to do that. And then when I think of the things I do with lambs, again, sort of in theory, what I'm doing is searching the lambs community, looking at all these amazing sequences other people have had, considering how I might use them, reflecting on the designs, and so on. That's the theory. The brutally honest truth is that while I do that, and that gives me ideas from time to time, when I have to teach a course today in a few hours, what I do is I load up a blank authoring lambs environment and I build it on the spot and I go. The idea that we would carefully plan and think through and consider other work to design and then get to an end point, in my practical life, that doesn't actually happen. It's not that it's not relevant. I do think about all that wider alignments and objectives and so on. And my life as a teacher is informed by other great sequences I've seen, but it isn't a connected process. It's more that they are all part of a background, but when it hits the moment when I have to teach in 2 hours and I'm putting something together, the bit that Lambs actually really helps me with is not all of this, it's the fact that I can quickly just drag, drop, fill in, save, bang, and I'm done. That's in fact the bit that ends up mattering in my busy life as a teacher. I hope confessing this is not some terrible disappointment to you all, but I feel like if I don't say this, I'm not, you know, this is at least my reality as a busy teacher, separate from my life as a researcher of learning design. And so if that voice is absent from our thoughts here, I worry that we won't get the right connection. I hope I haven't ruined the day.
I think that's right, James. Just because you haven't reused something doesn't mean it's been shared, though. I think most people do good stuff, but most practice is quite implicit. You go in and teach whatever. But the fact that you're looking at other stuff, you're picking up ideas, and when you write your own, you're picking up those experiences. And I think people get hung up with technical shareability, not cultural shareability. And I think it's exposing ideas out so that people can identify what is different and think about it. Whether they actually share it in terms of, I'm going to reuse this document that I've used, or whether they reuse those ideas that they've picked up. They may even forgot where they saw it, but they're changing practice. And I think that's the exciting bit about this stuff. But there's a lot of focus on technical reshare, and I don't think many staff would actually reuse completely an element. They'll pick up bits and bobs from other places.
The green light? Yeah. I've started to wonder whether we're being a little bit too highbrow about some of this. We're trying to be very careful and tiptoeing around making sure that the intellectual property of people's courses are intact and that they can do the development. I'm starting to come to the conclusion that they don't necessarily want to think. I think that perhaps they want it done for them. So this first year psychology course that you're going to write may be the only way we start getting things out there. And as long as it can be edited, so that when they look at the whole thing that they're given on a plate, they can say, well, hey, yeah, I like that, and that. And I don't like that, so I'll change that. But the rest of it is all done for me. And I think we're dealing with really, really busy lecturers, and to expect them to start from scratch might be just philosophically the absolute correct way about it, but in reality I'm not sure that that approach is going to work unless there's a formal course involved. And I guess with the reusability thing, I always go back to the fact that textbooks have survived so well and are so heavily used, particularly in the school sector. And what are they except totally prepared courses that people can dip in and out of and use as they like? So I'm wondering whether once we start getting a critical mass of whole courses being written or whole activities being written, maybe then people will start to access those and look at it. But it's going to be a chicken and egg situation. Until we get this massive, fully prepared set of resources, people won't want to look at them. But how are we going to develop this fully set of resources that are already there and done? And I'm starting to come to the conclusion that with our planner project, if we can develop a generic planner, that would be great. But until we start populating it with content that is totally specific to exactly what people want, then we may not get people using them.
It's beginning to feel like a kind of Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I'm Martin Muller and I don't share either. But, but I do, actually I do reuse now, and the medium I reuse through is through the blogosphere. So, you know, I reuse video clips, I reuse slide share things, you know, and I reuse Flickr photos. I think we've always struggled with the kind of mentality of reuse, but and I think what you were talking about earlier, James, kind of there's a, it kind of took us 10 years to kind of get to the idea of the read-write web. And and Clay Shirky makes the same argument. It's like it's when technology, and you look at the uptake of mobile phones, it's when they become pervasive in society that's when you start seeing the big changes, it's the kind of social change. So I think the kind of attitude towards reuse is now kind of reaching a reasonable sort of state. And so it wouldn't seem unusual to go in and think, I need to create a course, what has someone else done beforehand? Whereas that would have seemed odd few years ago, people wouldn't have thought of doing that. Now, you'll certainly start going and thinking, like, what stuff can I grab? What learning objects? What, you know, iTunes University video clips can I put in there? You know, so I think the kind of general attitude towards reuse has changed, and I think we'll begin to see that. And I think learning design is kind of a bit further down the road of that, because it's different from, you know, taking a Flickr photo is one thing, taking a kind of a design of a course is another. But I think it you know, that groundwork has started now, I think.
I'd like to add to that, again, from very much from the ground floor, being a lecturer, busy lecturer, trying to fit everything in. What my colleagues, what I'm hearing them say all the time is, what we don't want is provide recipes for our students to go away and take stuff. And they always want recipes. Just give me the stuff and then I can reuse it straight away. I'm very much tempted giving them some foundation so they can go out and do it. So the learning design I can see is very much that, but what I find is a philosophical tension there, and what I haven't heard so much here is that philosophical debate that should happen, I think. And this is where I think if we want some take-up of the reusability and learning design, we really have to engage with the notion, is it okay to reuse, and what does it mean? And is it okay if we, let's say, we take the book analogy and say, I'm very happy for you to take my book, but I'm not quite sure if I would be happy if you rip half of it out and say, well, this is her book, and replace it with something else. So these are lots of value issues that we need to address, I think.
Maybe if I can just comment on that one. In the area of what are called patterns, some of you may know in the area of architecture, Alexander developed this idea of patterns, which are sort of short descriptions of a typical problem that crops up if you're designing a building or a, you know, something. And it identifies the nature of the problem. It then puts forward some kind of solution, but in a general way, to give you some thought about how you cross this. And so patterns, while they arose in architecture, they've become very common in software in the last 10 years. There's a lot of work on software patterns, standard ways to try and solve particular problems. And there have been some people working on educational patterns. I think Davinia and some of your colleagues and others have worked on this similar idea. And Peter Goodyear, Patrick McAndrew, and I, a year or two ago, looked at this and wrote a paper. And one of the things I learnt in that process was, in the field of patents, it is very important that you don't just give people a solution. You know, in our current context, if the patent describes a problem where you need students to discuss and debate, the solution is not, here's a LAMB sequence, go run this, because it destroys the whole point where the idea of the patent was actually to identify the problem, to give you sort of the essence of an idea to solve it, but you had to take it on and then develop that solution and implement it yourself. If you did not, you know, do the hard effort, as I think the phrase is, the creative leap needed to go from the pattern to what you do in reality, the instantiation. If that is missing, then, you know, you've not achieved what patterns are about. And I've certainly had moments where I've had this fear that if we had pre-built